You are listening to the Monaco Daily, first broadcast on the 6th of May 2024 on Monaco Radio. Israel makes good on its promise to invade Rafah, at least partially. Should Ukrainian men of military age abroad be stripped of consular services? And why is Children's Day no longer the happiest day of our lives? I'm Chris Chermak. The Monaco Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monaco Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. My guests, Daniela Pellad and Lisette Raymer, will discuss the day's big stories and we'll hear from the curator of a new exhibition on the birth of Expressionist art in Munich just before the First World War. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monaco Daily. This is the Monaco Daily and I'm Chris Chermak. I'm joined today by Daniela Pellad, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and by Lisette Raymer, the Europe Correspondent for News Hub NZ. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Lisette, we're going to start with you for some interesting yet slightly depressing reporting that you've been on for our introductory chat. You've been to Ethiopia in the last week.
Yeah, I spent a little over a week in Ethiopia covering the progressively desperate situation. They are on really the brink of a famine, and 21 million people in Ethiopia alone who are struggling for food at the moment don't know where their next meal is coming from. So it's one of those things that is a little bit forgotten in the world at the moment, honestly, because of the gravity of what else is going on. But the size of it, the scale of it is so huge that it really shouldn't be as forgotten in the headlines as it is.
We've spoken about that a couple of times on this show in the last weeks about sort of these forgotten crises, and that's certainly one of them.
Big time, yeah.
Daniela, on a happier note, I suppose, I'm just going to pivot to you and say, you know, while Ethiopia is one thing to do, you were hobnobbing with journalists in the last week or so.
I was. This is a couple of weeks now, but I was at the International Journalism Festival in Perugia. I believe there was a Monaco correspondent there too, but we didn't meet amid the hobbing and the nobbing. But it was a really, really interesting collection. I think it's the largest journalism festival in Europe. Lots of talk of AI, lots of conversations about Israel-Palestine, lots of voices from the Middle East and Africa. It was really fascinating.
Fascinating. Did you learn anything new about the state of journalism?
Apparently, according to some of the people from Google News and Meta and so forth, AI is fine and we shouldn't worry. And actually, it'll be a tool for journalists. And it's a bit like a glorified spell check. So, you know, good news.
It's fine. It's just fine.
Yeah, I think the assembled hacks took it with a grain of salt, but they did sort of fund, I think, quite a lot of the Prosecco. So that's par for the course.
Always helps for journalists. Well, we will start today's show in Gaza, where Israel has today seemingly begun preparations for something almost nobody wants, but everybody knew was coming. Israel has urged more than 100,000 Palestinians to leave eastern Rafah and head to an expanded humanitarian zone ahead of what Israel is calling a limited operation in the southern Gazan city. Over the course of today, Palestinians have begun complying, while explosions could already be heard in Rafah. Whether the other 1.2 million Palestinians in Rafah will also be asked to leave shortly remains an open question. Daniela, in just the last hour, we've also heard that Hamas says it has agreed to the terms of a ceasefire in Gaza. Does that change the equation at all? Was anything realistically going to stop what is happening in Rafah right now?
Well, before the news that Israeli troops are planning a limited move into Rafah, there was no clear answer that Hamas had turned down the ceasefire. You're absolutely right. This is the Rafah operation is something that really almost nobody wanted. The Americans have been very clear that this is something that they want to rule out. I believe Netanyahu and Biden had a half an hour conversation today. The Europeans, very clear. Within Israel, as we've spoken about multiple times, Netanyahu is increasingly wildly unpopular. The general mood of the public is the most important thing now to do is to have a hostage release deal. I mean, it was clear from day one, the way you release the hostages is through a prisoner exchange. It's clear that huge military incursions, you know, looking at the Israelis, looking at it from a sort of domestic, you know, self-interested point of view, will be more likely to end in the deaths of hostages rather than the release. Mm. The people that want this move, the hardliners who are against any kind of prisoner swap concession, the minority maybe, but they're the people that Netanyahu relies on to keep his government in power.
Just to follow up on that, Daniela, I mean, do you think, though, if there is this ceasefire deal being agreed, I mean, Netanyahu has said he would go ahead and invade Rafah with or without a ceasefire deal. So I just wonder what your sense is of whether that would change anything. Could a prisoner exchange still go ahead even with that? I mean, would it keep it to maybe this more limited operation that Israel is talking about?
Yeah, I think Israel has definitely left themselves a ladder to climb down when it comes to this. They've been very clear. This is a limited operation. This is not a ground invasion, etc., etc. They've made that quite clear. And you know, we've seen in the last few weeks the Europeans and the Americans starting to use as leverage some moves, which you know could be argued they could have used long before this this latest part of the conflict. Things like, you know, levying bans on extremist groups. You know, much more talk about banning settlement goods or labelling, these kind of diplomatic measures, which seemed a step too far when there was no active conflict, but now seems a little not a step far enough. But you know, the tide is clearly turning, and it's hugely embarrassing for Biden to be in this position where he seems to be telling Netanyahu one thing and he's doing another. Meanwhile, he continues to supply him weapons. Domestically, that's kind of excruciating.
Well, excruciating domestically, absolutely. I mean, Lizette, what have you made of kind of this leverage, I suppose, then? Do you also get the sense that it is shifting in Europe, in the US? There's more of a willingness to exercise not just words to Netanyahu, but that some governments are now more willing to actually put actions behind those words.
Yeah, I definitely agree with what's already been said. I think half of this, though, has come from the population that is starting to really ramp up the pressure on their governments and on their leaders. And I think that's where the disconnect comes in, and definitely what you're seeing in America is whether or not the public's frustration and disbelief of the situation is now actually going to result in Biden putting more action to his words, because there has been a lot of, oh, we're amping up the warnings, or we're being stronger in our conversations with Netanyahu than ever. But then, as you say, still supplying the weapons and still really making very little impact in the war. I think I've just been reading the statement that Hamas has put out following this developing news on the deal, and they've said the ball is now in Israel's court. And I think that's interesting also to really push the optics of that decision, that we are wanting a ceasefire, and anything that happens from this point on is firmly on Israel. They are the ones that are making the decision to go ahead with this operation in Rafah. They are the one that have declined the option, the opportunity to stop this and have a break. And I think there's been a lot of conversations from the governments around the world that if we can just get Israel to agree to a ceasefire, and if it's staggered like it's been in the past, obviously we don't know the terms of this agreement, but if it's a staggered ceasefire that is drawn out over a couple months in terms of the process of getting different hostages released, the hope from, I think, the international community is that by the end of that, things will have been quiet for so long that the IDF then would find it incredibly hard to go ahead with any sort of operation in Rafah.
Daniela, one other aspect of also this call with Joe Biden, as I understand, was about the humanitarian situation, which has always been, of course, such a key issue in this. And one of the key humanitarian crossings from Egypt had been closed today. And this was apparently part of what Biden told Netanyahu. He has to keep the humanitarian situation, you know, these borders open for humanitarian aid. UNRWA has said that they are staying the UN despite this potential limited operation. Aid groups have been briefed on what's happening, but how dangerous is this situation?
I mean, the crossing was closed in response to Hamas rocket fire that killed several Israeli soldiers. So that is the the context of that, but it's quite clear that not enough aid is getting in. But I think we're looking at aid as, I mean, it's a tiny sticking plaster on an enormous wound. Even if the Gaza was aid reliant before 7th of October, the level of destruction is so huge that humanitarian aid is going to, all it can do is ameliorate the disaster and, you know, prevent widespread famine. I think now as well, more than 6 months on, there's a lot of talk been ramping up on what happens the day after. What happens the day after the war has ended. I mean, you know, patience is running out. The Israeli public's patience is running out as well. And I've heard more and more suggestions leaked, not leaked. You know, the idea that there's going to be an international force, an Arab-led force, the PA is going to take over Gaza, and that's when the real reconstruction will begin. But, you know, the amount of aid that's getting in at the moment is minimal, and it would need just a huge, huge influx to make a significant difference.
What have you made of that, Lisette? I was wondering about that too, this idea of what happens next and what role Europe, the US, would play in that. There is this big question, isn't there, of aside from the incredible situation on the ground right now, what does happen next and who is going to take charge of rebuilding the entire region?
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive, massive undertaking. And it's, I think for a lot of people, I find it, even personally myself, hard to think about what comes next when you see the scale of what's going on right now. And I think when I was in Israel last, you can kind of start having those conversations with people. But really, the general feeling is we need to get a solution right now before we even contemplate the next step. Like, there's no point having disagreements about the future when right now we haven't even managed to stop the initial travesty that's occurring. So I think that is such a big, big complicated question, but I don't think it should be distracting right now from getting things sorted and getting those people in Gaza to safety.
Just a final word on this, Daniela, because Lisette mentioned the protests, and I was just curious from your perspective, has that had an effect? Do you imagine that is having an effect on governments? Joe Biden specifically was asked about this on Friday when he gave a statement about, or Thursday, I think it was, about the protests. You know, would this have an impact on his approach to Gaza? He flatly said no.
Well, I think that one of the many problems of this conflict with Israel-Palestine in general is it is just adopted as part of the culture wars. And the Palestinian cause has, you know, for decades been sort of somewhat fetishized by the left in Europe and globally. And then the Israelis have been seen as a sort of cause célèbre for the right wing. And it often has very, very little to do with what's going on the ground. Some of the rhetoric I've heard from Colombia and so on is just sort of so divorced from the idea that of what's happening, the reality of people, the idea that somehow Israelis or Palestinians are going to leave the territory, you know, this sort of magical realism is not going to happen. I think it can also have a backlash as well. You know, the more, I think that was the case here. There was, I mean, perhaps unfairly, you know, the pro-Palestine protesters were being seen as rabble-rousing and violent and making London dangerous. And I think that's only a small minority. But we were warned that Labour's stance over Gaza was going to have a devastating effect on the mayoral elections and the local elections. And that just didn't happen. It's also slightly, I think, demeaning to say that, you know, the Muslim people will vote against or vote for over a single issue. It's true, Labour might have lost some support, but I don't think this was the issue on what the elections were fought.
I think it's interesting. I think you can underestimate the power of the people. And I think just for me personally, I've just seen it play out in New Zealand, which obviously is a world away. But our protests have been growing month on month, week on week, since the October 7th event. And finally, we're seeing our government actually change their approach and not be so concerned and fearful about their decisions and how they treat this. And they did just come out after the last major protest and finally agree to classify Hamas as a terror organisation. So I think, like, those protests do have the power to impact our politicians. And I think that's starting to see that.
Well, let's move to Paris now, where Chinese President Xi Jinping has arrived for talks with Emmanuel Macron and will, as we speak, be getting ready to imbibe some French brandy that his own government has opened an anti-dumping investigation on back home. Averting a trade war is one key topic between the two leaders. Another is likely to be Ukraine. Macron has been hoping to get China to join a peace summit for Ukraine in Switzerland happening next month. Not to be outdone, Vladimir Putin is also scheduled to visit Beijing next month to reaffirm their partnership. Lisette, one of the things that I find interesting about this is it's been a little bit of a game of chicken when it comes to the trade war stuff at the moment, hasn't it? Kind of both sides want to avert a trade war. They want to have good relations, but only if they get what they want.
Yeah, but isn't that the story of all of the conversations at the moment that involve China? I feel like every country around the world is trying to walk that very fine line. I think people, and this is the whole conversation, is that we need to de-risk our reliance on China. Countries all around the world know that it's very hard at the moment for their economies to exist without them, but then they understand that that is such a complicated relationship to have at the moment. I think, it's going to be very interesting to see how Macron handles those conversations. Same, I think Ursula von der Leyen has probably been the most stern in terms of we can't have you coming over here with all your electric vehicles and putting our businesses at risk and at jeopardy when yours are state supported. It's just not a fair situation. And as much as we need and we appreciate what you're doing in that space, we can't have it compromise our own, which I think is a very reasonable debate. But you cannot maybe speak reason to reason in some of these conversations. And that's where this is going to become very difficult for them.
Both reason to reason, but also just this strange balance, isn't it, when you talk about something like de-risking, just to follow up on that. I mean, it is this question of how do you avert a trade war while also promising to de-risk from China and pull businesses out and ban TikTok for that matter.
Absolutely. And even just we're just at the recent NATO summits and they're always talking about how one of the biggest global security risks at the moment is China. So you're having all of these countries getting together and having big meetings where they're publicly talking about how worried they are about China generally. And then you're having a handshake picture and everyone's big smiles for the camera. It is very, very difficult to compute those two things side by side and think that Xi Jinping hasn't got some serious questions to be bringing to the table when they do get into that meeting.
Daniela, speaking of desires and wants from Macron, I mean, is it at all possible, do you think, to shift China's policy towards Ukraine? Is that something where you feel like you would like to see them play a bigger role? Is that something we can even hope for?
I think they would like to play a role, but you know, the question is what's in it for them? I mean, why would they shift their position? I think they would shift their position, give it a few months. Sadly, things are not going well in Ukraine, and it's important to note who else Jinping was meeting. And he was also going to Serbia and Hungary. I mean, the most sort of pro-Russian actors maybe in the European space, you know, they're also very reliant on China for trade. So I think that was sending really quite a strong signal. Look, China has also indicated its willingness and it actually being quite keen to be involved in Ukrainian peace negotiations, the Ukrainian peace deals. But what some of us will think of a peace deal for Ukraine, others would see as, you know, completely off the table. There's a huge
peace for land.
Well, exactly. You know, and that's not something that Ukraine is willing to look at with some very good reason. It would also send a pretty alarming precedent as well. So China's in a good position, really, when it comes to Ukraine. Its alliance with Russia is strong over this. And what's happening in Ukraine really supports the theory that, you know, the age of democracy is over and now it's time for a different dynamic dominated by Russia and China. And then the two of them can kind of fight it out afterwards.
Lisette, I mean, speaking of, as Daniela mentioned there, these other trips that Xi Jinping is taking. I mean, the other aspect of that that's interesting is Europe has power if it holds together.
Yes.
Is she, or clearly she is trying to exploit that somewhat and sow those divisions by visiting countries like Hungary and Serbia?
Absolutely. And he's, again, not the first. We've seen that exactly with the war in Ukraine. The Russian approach has been to try and divide the European nations. And I think it's interesting. My sense was last time the EU got together and voted on the Ukrainian package, aid package, they pretty much just discounted Hungary and said, we actually can't be bothered even pretending that this is unanimous anymore. You're trying to cause trouble and we just actually can't be bothered. It's like, we're not going to let this come across as if we're not unified. We are unified except for you. So I think it's going to be very interesting if that same kind of approach holds up against China as well. But obviously, it's not surprising at all to see that Xi Jinping has circled out and pointed out those same sort of friendly countries or friendlier countries that Russia has.
Well, let's move on a little bit, because while Xi and Macron aim to decide the world's fate over glasses of cognac, Ukraine still has a war to fight and it is fast running short on manpower. Efforts to increase conscription numbers have taken on different constellations in recent months. One aspect of a new law taking effect this month is the suspension of consular services for military-eligible men living abroad. It is estimated that around 650,000 Ukrainian men who could be conscripted have been living elsewhere on the European continent since the war began. Daniela, I know from some personal experience of having, when I visited, how it is not that easy to sneak out of the country. I was on a bus out of Ukraine in south to Romania, and I was the only man on that bus because it is very hard for men to actually leave the country. Which does make me just ask, is this a sign of desperation from Ukraine to be trying to pull back people who clearly did not want to be there?
It sounds a little bit desperate, but I think it's also sending a message, a domestic message, really. When, you know, Ukraine is under huge pressure, and the soldiers are under huge pressure as well. It's been unclear how long people fighting in frontline positions are expected to serve for, how long they can serve for. It's also not just a question of, like, of, you know, reeling in some university students and sending them to the front. I mean, that's not the kind of war that they're fighting. But I think it does. It seems potentially one that would backfire. I mean, there are a lot of Ukrainian men who are outside the country, who are studying, who are working, or who are exempt for other reasons. You know, if you have three children or more, you don't need to fight. I mean, and it's true, when you leave Ukraine, when you cross the border, you see very few men leaving. It's mostly like women and grannies coming in and out. But at the same time, that there are men in civilian clothes in the streets of Ukrainian cities. It's not like the country is completely mobilized to that every last man is fighting on the front line. And
that's what I wanted to ask you. In a way, is it your sense that this is the kind of action that needs to be taken because there are not enough people left in Ukraine? As you say, there are people in Ukraine still who also are avoiding this, perhaps from within Ukraine.
But you need consensus, and you need to build public trust. You need to build public trust that there is a huge amount of patriotic feeling and patriotic fervor. And I think the what you hear from Ukrainians, how it's, you know, been reported outside the country, they're saying, well, we do everything we can to support, and we're sending money, and we're raising money, and we're raising awareness. Not being in the army is not the only way to serve. Mm. And it's true, not every person is a great candidate for to serve in the army. And it's also not just about men as well. There are plenty of women serving in the army. But bringing in a few thousand more unwilling grunts, if you will, from abroad is not going to make the decisive factor in this. But I think it is a bit cheering for Ukrainians, perhaps, who are in the country and who are experiencing this war, for the state to say, okay, we're going to make it a little bit harder for the people who aren't there. You know, it's a sort of some psychological victory there.
There is this psychological battle, I suppose, Lisette. And I guess, you can see it from both sides of that, making the life a little bit harder for those in the diaspora. But I do also wonder if there's this risk, as Daniela was also saying, of kind of those in the diaspora who were helping and make this point that we have been helping in other ways. They have been Ukraine's best advocates.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. I've been in and out of Ukraine several times since the war started. And the biggest thing I've noticed has been the change in attitude on the ground among the men. When I first arrived, everyone, I've heard it so many times and so strongly that there were rumours of men trying to sneak across the border in women's clothing, and people would spit on their names. They are cowards. They are unpatriotic. They are running away from their duty. It was so, so strongly felt, that belief. The last time I was there, which was just for the anniversary, every single person I spoke to, I think, said to me, oh, I don't want my husband to go fighting or my partner to go fighting. My boyfriend hasn't been called up yet. We're hoping he isn't. A lot of people saying they've been avoiding getting conscripted. And that was something I'd never heard before, this openness about not wanting to go and fight, that first sign of division among the domestic population of, okay, maybe I don't want to go and put my life at risk for this, what is rapidly becoming an endless war.
Is that where you felt like it came from, the fact that this has been going on for so long? Or was it also, the other question I always have is sort of with aid from Europe and the US and the questions from abroad and how long that support will go, is that kind of feeding into this?
A combination, but I definitely think just this isn't going to be a quick all hands on deck, we can win this war and we'll be all back to normal in 6 months' time. And it ties into what you were saying, is there's no formal time period that people are on the front line for. They don't know when they're going to get released and come back and see their families for the weekend or for a few months before they go back out. But then on the other hand, absolutely, you're hearing from even the soldiers themselves that they don't want any just Joe Blogs coming down here to the front line and trying to maintain the line that they've been protecting with their blood and sweat for the last 2 years. Mm. They don't want people just coming out here, being called up and handed a gun, especially when, as you've referenced, a lot of those people know where their skills lie and they're using them in other areas. And you hear that time and time again also with a lot of the men who have started up charities or humanitarian aid networks within the country who are spearheading them and doing life-saving work in their own way. And they're saying, look, I'm happy to go fight if I'm called on, but I actually think the government knows that I'm better used here. And so I think it's a real fine line between keeping that unity in the country and needing men on the front line, because I think if they keep on coming out with things like this and forcing people to come to the front line that shouldn't be there or don't want to be there, it's only going to add to the internal distrust.
Just a final word on that, Daniela. I mean, it has often been said that Ukraine's advantage in this war, if it has one, lies in its morale and the fact that it is fighting for its country. Is that in danger of slipping?
I think it's still very strong. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that this is the trend. There is a bit more scepticism about serving, or you know, the idea that people don't want their teenage sons to sign up, because they're weary, and they're weary and they're worried, and it's very obvious that you know the US may have belatedly agreed some, you know, the aid. However, you know, the pressure is on for a deal. So what would they be fighting for, really, to sort of solidify Russia's gains in this war? But I think I agree that Ukrainian morale has been a huge factor in this, and especially the fighting forces. I mean, if you look at the makeup of the Russian fighting forces, and you know the lack of training and who they're recruiting, and the Russians, by the way, are also getting quite desperate to recruit people as well, and they're bringing in lots of Central Asians, you know, fairly forcibly. I still think Ukrainian morale is holding strong.
Well, speaking of sending daughters and sons to war, I'm going to take a hard, hard 180 turn right now on this show, because finally for our panel, it is Children's Day, or at least it was in South Korea yesterday. A bit like Mother's Day, every country seems to have its own date for this particular holiday. But more interesting than the actual holiday is how it's viewed by the South Korean population itself. According to the Korea Happiness Report 2024, Children's Day was the happiest day of the year back in 2018. Now it is just 146th. So basically just your average day of the year. No better, no worse. Daniela as the representative parent on this panel. Does that sound about right? 146th in your line of 365 days?
Well, I know. Well, I would say that 365 days of the year are children's day in terms of, like, you know, telling people to go and brush their teeth and making packed lunches and so on. I think it's kind of strange to have these children's days, Mother's Days, Father's Day. And I wonder, it is generally, it's generally just sort of a money-making tool. I don't know what they do to celebrate Children's Day.
Well, apparently the reasons, it is sort of sad, the reasons it's now 146 is related to what they do, because apparently parents can no longer afford the gifts and expensive dinners out that they were doing for those days beforehand.
Well, I think one of the problems as well, many places in the world, is that people, parents can't afford the children, full stop. That, you know, the birth rate is dropping because not only is it expensive, but also societies, you know, across the world, the circumstances, they don't make it easy for people to have children, for women to have children, for women to have children and to go back to work and to pursue their careers. And especially in conservative societies like Korea, like Japan, you know, the idea that you have this sort of maternal mother stay at home. And it, you know what? It doesn't really work. It doesn't really work.
Lisette, it could be worse. This day was 258th on this list at the height of the pandemic. I mean, did the pandemic kind of kill our love for kids?
Gosh, what a way to pitch it.
I think Daniela has some things to say on that too.
I know. I'm not a parent, so maybe I haven't experienced the true distress of the pandemic.
Were you happily watching other friends you had who were parents thinking, thank God that wasn't me?
Yeah, well, to be fair, my siblings who are parents were actually quite happy during the pandemic because their husbands weren't working and had to stay at home and help with the kids. So they were actually relieved by the pandemic's bonus there of having a second parent around more hands on deck. But, you know, it's an interesting one. I didn't even know that Children's Day existed, to be fair. So
no, I didn't really know either. It was not something we celebrated as children.
I'm certainly not getting my son any extra presents.
Well, I did want to end the show by asking, I suppose, in honor of Children's Day, I'll start with you, Daniela. What is the funniest and or brattiest thing your child has ever said to you?
What, today?
Any day. What comes to mind as a favorite story of your child, either making your life hell or making your life happy?
I mean, like, no, he does both. He does both every day. But gosh, I feel a bit put on the spot. No, I would say that in general, my kid is not only is decorative, you know, and amusing and cuddly, but also useful. He's at home right now doing the laundry. So I think so brattish, amusing, cute and annoying in equal measures.
I can say the one that I was thinking of for this story was just watching the smallest of examples, but being at a tourist spot in Quebec, I think it was, and I'm trying to take a picture at the tourist spot and a child about five walks in front and the parent sort of hastily tries to intervene and says sort of, you know, look, there's a picture being taken there. There's a picture, you know, do you see? The child just looks back at her mother and says, so? Et alors, in French?
Your point?
Your point. Yeah. Lisette, any favorite stories that have made you want or not want to have kids?
Oh, look, I think I probably am more on the want side when I see the other people's kids and then I see the nappies and I'm less inspired. But, oh, look, I don't know. I don't have any major story that jumps to mind. But having just been in Africa, which is covering, you know, a really horrific situation, but I was constantly struck by the children that we met and their ability to still be smiling and find some happiness in the days. And I think that's what I love about children, is that sometimes they're able to ignore the realities of the world a little bit easier than adults and can still run around with each other and have a good time and you know, have that childlike view of the world, which I think is always quite nice.
That innocence is absolutely an extraordinary ability. So happy Children's Day, everyone. Daniela Pellet and Lisette Raymer, thank you very much for joining us. And finally, on today's show, the Blaue Reiter, or Blue Rider Group of Expressionist Artists in pre-First World War Munich, is the subject of a new exhibition at the Tate Modern here in London this summer. It's a collaboration with Munich's Lenbachhaus Gallery and includes paintings by Blue Rider founders Vasily Kandinsky and Franz Marc. The art is characterized by a desire to express personal experiences and spiritual ideas in a society on the precipice of the First World War. Monocle Radio's George Ruskin spoke to the Tate Exhibition's curator, Natalia Sidlina. George began by asking what brought the Blue Rider group together.
The thing about the Blue Rider is that it stepped away from the constraints of organized group or an association. They didn't have formal membership. They didn't have a similar style that connected them all. They came from all across the world, from the US, Eastern Europe, Western Europe. They all shared migratory experiences and had complex identities. They were the first collective to proclaim that art knows no boundaries or nations, only humanity. We wanted to highlight the concentric circles of friendships and collaborations between intimate friends, best mates, creative collaborators, compatriots, people who shared similar quest for spirituality. And this is something very important for creative communities of today, because they share very, very similar concerns, such as multiple identities, fluid sexuality, a struggle with creativity, migratory experiences, everyday misogynism, trauma of war and loss. We tend to look at the genealogy of the Blue Rider as Kandinsky, Munter, Verovkin and Yevlensky. Kandinsky felt that he was ready to sail by himself with the support of a group of much younger artists around him who supported, invigorated, encouraged and inspired him. Because Kandinsky was one of the artists who survived the First World War, this mythology forms part of the genealogy of Kandinsky as a master and inventor of abstract art he himself created.
Let's move away from Kandinsky now, because I know one of your major ambitions for this exhibition is to shine a light on some of the lesser celebrated members, particularly the women of Expressionism. Tell me about some of them.
It's an incredible opportunity for us to introduce the names of women very few of our visitors would have heard of. Of course, many of them would know Gabriela Munter, Kandinsky's partner in life, an artist who had chosen a different part to Kandinsky. She used to say the Blue Rider was a friendship rather than a group, and they were more interested in supporting each other and in the happiness and health of each other rather than of proclaiming loud statements and manifestos. So she opened the doors of her house to so many artists who could come and find the platform for discussion. She was an experimental photographer, and her work as photographer influenced Kandinsky as much as she was influenced by him. Lemberhaus's incredible collection of expressionist art and this exhibition wouldn't have been possible if it wasn't for Munter's generosity. She preserved the works of the Blue Rider artist through two world wars and gave it to the city of Munich in 1957. If it wasn't for her, so many works simply wouldn't have survived during the Nazi regime. So apart from her contribution as an artist, apart from her bold experimentation, we're also grateful to her as an art historian who preserved, interpreted, and then was generous enough to share all this wealth with the world through this incredible donation.
How challenging was it to curate an exhibition based on a grouping, or not a group, you call it a community of artists, that are so disparate and the similarities between them are so abstract? How did you go about in your curatorial process putting together this exhibition?
I think this is what makes Blue Rider legacy long-living, the fact that there was this vibrant community, the fact that they've embraced plurality of forms, but also the fact that community shared so many similar beliefs, issues and concerns our artistic community of the 21st century shares that resonate so strongly with them. And my colleagues coming freshly from the Venice Biennale can't stop telling me of the similarities between thinking about migratory experiences, thinking about the forgotten artist and the ideas of support of the creative community. It's all started at the early years of the 20th century with the Blue Rider. Also, the concept of artist as an art theoretician, artist as a writer, as artist as a critic, and artist as a curator, which a contemporary creative community would find very close to their heart. All was pioneered by the Blue Rider artist. And for me, as curator, I should say, working off this exhibition was like having Christmas every day. My visits to the stores of the Lambert House, where you can see all those works you can only see either by going to Munich or on the pages of the art historical books and exhibition catalogues, being able to look at them, to make selection which will speak to our audiences here in London, was a privilege.
What's your favourite work in this exhibition?
Honestly, it's like asking your mother to say which one of your children is your favourite. So every single work in this show was chosen by me, and I could not imagine the show if you take any single one of them out. I think all of them tell the story which contributes to this kaleidoscopic, vibrant picture of what the Blau Rider project was all about.
That was Tate curator Natalia Sidlina speaking with Monocle's George Ruskin. And that's all the time we have for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panelists today, Daniela Pellid and Lisette Raymer. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by Gunnar Grunlid. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Chris Chermak here in London. The Monocle is back. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye and thanks for listening.